Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Migraines are miserable. Hours, even days of head-pounding pain. They're real and debilitating. Just ask the millions of Americans, as many as 1 in 10, who've been suffering with them for years and were told that the problem was psychological. Nowadays, migraines are understood as a real physical illness and a public health issue. We'll take a closer look. This hour, On Point, Living with Migraines. Later this hour, we'll be speaking with a writer for the New York Times blog called Migraine, Perspectives on a Headache. It started up earlier this month, but joining me first in the studio is Dr. Elizabeth Loader. She's chief of the Division of Headache and Pain at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Faulkner Hospitals in Boston. She teaches neurology at Harvard Medical School, and she's editor of the books Headache and Migraine in Women. Dr. Loader, so nice to have you with us. Thanks.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Madison, Wisconsin, is Martha Gay. She has had migraines for the past 24 years. Welcome to you, Martha.
Thanks, Jane.
I want to start with you and have you help our listeners understand what a migraine feels like. Can you describe it?
Well, for me, my first migraine literally knocked me off my feet. It was a pain that was so intense that I couldn't be upright. I had to lie down. For me, a migraine itself is a pounding pain in my temples that feels like something trying to break through them from the inside. People who know me know I have a migraine when I squeeze my temples with one hand. I feel like I'm trying to hold my brain in. I can hear my pulse pounding in my ears, and it's so loud it hurts, but then again, my hearing becomes so sensitive that I hear everything and all sound hurts. My eyes can't stand any light, and it hurts to move my eyeballs at all. Any movement of my body, any movement at all, hurts my head. I've had in the past dizziness that's so profound that I've had to stop driving and call my husband to have him pick me up because I was afraid I would crash. Sometimes I have nausea, but obviously, the hallmark of the migraine is this tremendous pain.
Dr. Loader, you hear this description, and it is terrible. Physiologically, what is going on in the brain when a person has a migraine?
Well, I'm glad you said what's going on in the brain, because for many years, people attributed migraine to problems with blood vessels. And that actually stymied a lot of research and thinking in the field. It is very clear now from medical research that migraine is a problem that starts in the brain. It's inherited to some degree. The threshold at which someone will develop a migraine is determined by genetics, but then environmental factors play a very big role. And it may be somewhat of an oversimplification, but I think probably a good way of explaining what's going on in migraine is to think of people with migraine as having a low threshold for being able to tolerate sensory stimulation or outside stimulation of any kind.
So how would you differentiate a migraine from, you know, just a bad headache?
Well, Martha's description actually contains everything a doctor would need in order to make a diagnosis of migraine. Without even being asked, she spontaneously describes this as a severe headache. She says it's throbbing. She tells us about associated features like nausea, sensitivity to light and noise. And in order to make a diagnosis of migraine, you know, we don't have any tests or imaging studies, x-rays or CT scans that prove whether you have a migraine. They can prove you don't have something else dangerous. But we make the diagnosis of migraine based on how patients describe the headache. And we do look for some of the things that Martha described. It's a fairly long headache if it's not treated. It's associated with nausea and then sensitivity to external stimuli like light and noise.
I mentioned the number of people, the number of Americans that suffer, 1 in 10 as many. Be more specific with those numbers, would you?
Well, you know, that overall number really hides the fact that migraine, by and large, is a condition that's especially troubling for women during their childbearing years. And at its peak prevalence in women, you know, in the 30s and 40s, up to a quarter of women suffer from migraine. If you look at just a one-year period, 18% of women and about 6% of men have a headache during that time that qualifies as migraine. But it's most active and most troubling and disabling in women in their middle years, and that's exactly when they have all kinds of other things going on. So it packs a big punch.
There was a time, especially with women, when migraines were dismissed as some sort of psychosomatic disorder, if you will. Tell us how that thinking has changed.
It is changing, but slowly, and I think some of the stigma still persists. You know, the fact that it doesn't kill people, the fact that it's intermittent and in between attacks people look perfectly fine, and the fact that it affects women, I think all of those things contribute to it not being taken as seriously as it should be. And when you add up the number of days of disability, missed work, and lost family time, among women, migraine turns out to be the 11th most disabling disorder out of all the medical conditions out there.
Martha, how has your chronic pain, your migraines, changed your life, your relationships? How has it changed you?
Well, you know, over the years, I have learned to accept that I was born with this unusually sensitive nervous system. And what that means is that you learn to accommodate it. I professionally, you know, I went on through graduate school and earned a doctorate, and it means that I've decided not to go for a tenure track academic position. I feel like my body can't take that kind of punishment. That would, you know, the whole publisher perish thing means that for me, I'm afraid that I would drive myself beyond what my body can take. And that's based on what happened in graduate school. I try very hard not to miss a meal because that's a guaranteed headache. I drink lots of water and non-caffeinated herbal tea to stay well hydrated. I am very careful with caffeine. I love red wine and can't drink it because it is also a guaranteed headache for me. I don't go out in the sun for more than a few minutes, and I mean 5 minutes, because that gives me a headache. I actually love cloudy days because I can go outside and open my eyes without pain. I don't go to concerts because they're too loud. It's a bummer because I love music. I recently did go to my daughter's percussion concert, and I plugged my ears the entire time, except for when her group played. And that turned out okay, but I can't go to her run-throughs for marching band most of the time because I just can't tolerate the pounding. So if I go there and I don't have a headache when I get there, I will by
when
the time
leave.
I leave.
So many triggers for so many different kinds of people. Dr. Loader, it sounds, you know, it sounds completely debilitating on so many levels and so many lives.
Well, it can be, and I hear stories similar to Martha's all the time, and I always think it's important for people who consider migraine just an intermittent problem to realize the impact it has on someone's life. I mean, Martha is describing big changes in her life, thinking about headache and what might trigger a headache all the time, even when she doesn't have headache. And I regularly see young people who've had to drop out of college because of headaches, people who, just as Martha said, don't go for some of the professional rewards that they might otherwise try to achieve because of the impact of headaches. And you don't get that time back later on, even if your headaches get better.
What about treatments, Dr. Loader? Are there new innovative treatments that have come about in the last few years?
You know, there's been a lot of progress made in treatment. I don't think it's nearly as good as it should be. And to some extent, that reflects the fact that research money from the government for migraine is really pathetic and low compared to other diseases that are much less common. And that's where I think sexism and, you know, still the stigma of a disorder that is or used to be thought of as psychological comes into play. I mean, it doesn't get nearly as much research attention as it should. But we do have treatments that can help a lot of people. They can't eliminate the tendency that you have to have migraine, but they can make it less likely to happen and help when the headaches do come.
Martha, in general and from your own experience, how well do you think the medical community has supported those with chronic pain, especially migraines in your case?
Well, it's very highly variable. You have these wonderful, wonderful, compassionate headache doctors every now and then. I personally have an incredible headache doctor who I work with very closely in controlling my migraines. And, you know, migraine is a moving target. I don't really think it's understood why it happens this way, but a medication that will work for a while suddenly stops working so well, and you have to sort of start over again and try something else.
Why is that, Dr. Loder? Let me jump in.
Well, there are a number of possible explanations for medications working for a while or seeming to work. One is that people tend to start medication when their headaches are at their absolute worst. And headache, like most other chronic diseases, waxes and wanes. You know, you have good periods and bad periods. And so statistically speaking, if you're just coming off a bad period and you start a medication, you know, you may be likely to see an improvement. Is it the drug or was it an improvement that was going to happen anyway? It can be very difficult to tell. It may also be the case that you know, receptors change in the central nervous system, making one less responsive to the drug. There may be changes in metabolism. But frankly, that's a problem we don't understand very well. It's certainly something I hear from patients, and it makes it necessary to be clever with the medication regimen sometimes.
Clever in what way?
Clever in terms of thinking of rotation of medications, switching from one to another, combining medications, and trying different ones to see which one a patient has a prolonged response to.
And a medication that works on one person might not work on the next person.
That's unfortunately true. We can tell you, based on studies in large groups of people, what percentage of people with migraine usually will respond to the drug. But, of course, that's not a guarantee that you're going to be among that percentage. So some degree of trial and error is necessary, and that can be wearing on everybody.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about coping with migraines, a disease that afflicts 30 million Americans. Dr. Elizabeth Loder is with us. She is chief of the Division of Headache and Pain at Brigham and Women's Faulkner Hospitals, one of the first headache clinics in the nation. Also with us from Madison, Wisconsin, is Martha Gay. She's had migraines since 1984. I'd like to go to the phones first out of the break here. A lot of calls to get to, and the first is Melissa from Salem, Massachusetts. Melissa, welcome to you.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a community health nurse and a migraine sufferer. I appreciate what Dr. Loder is saying. I want to underscore some of the things that I've experienced and seen as a patient and as a nurse.
Yeah.
I don't think the gender issues can be underestimated. We're still not out of the dark ages on that score. If you look at nursing research, neurological research, in the ambulatory setting, a huge number, sometimes as much as 80% of headaches are misdiagnosed as anxiety headaches rather than migraine headaches. Hmm. And by definition, because most women suffer, more women than men suffer from this, you're going to get a lot of gender bias in terms of treatment and women being dismissed as having an anxiety headache still. Secondly, on the pain management issue, in general, pain is very undermanaged. Nurses know this. Nurses are at the front line of this, let alone pain management for migraines. My doctor didn't give me any pain management for my migraine. She actually told me to not bring her my old baggage. That's a quote, even though I was a nurse and trying to advocate for myself. So if you have more nurse guests on your show or nurses become more prevalent in the public, you will hear them speaking out about the misdiagnosis of migraines and pain.
A couple of really good points, Melissa. Thanks so much for your call. Dr. Loder, have you seen this in your practice at the hospitals here, the misdiagnosis of anxiety headaches?
Well, I think Melissa's absolutely right that a lot of times headaches are attributed to stress or tension, and many patients who come into my office will talk about how frustrating it is to have well-meaning friends or relatives who send them clippings about how to relax or suggest that they learn to meditate.
Yes.
Now, like every chronic illness that waxes and wanes, asthma, all sorts of other things, you know, migraine is affected by stress and emotional tension, but that's a very different thing from being caused by it. And certainly we know that those things are not the underlying cause. And I think she's right that headaches are often written off to tension or stress. And a good rule of thumb is that if a headache is bad enough for a patient to see a doctor about it, it's really quite unlikely that it's a simple tension headache or a stress headache. It's probably something more serious like migraine that needs to be taken seriously.
Martha Gay, in your experience with headaches over these past 24 years, have you heard that? Oh, just lower the stress in your life and it'll go away?
Oh, my God. If I had a nickel for every time I heard that. You know, my response to that is, you know, I'm actually a nurse also, and I have a lot of people come to me with migraine issues. And I've heard a friend of mine told me when her daughter went to a neurologist with migraine problems and the medication didn't work, he said it must be because she doesn't like school. And it's this kind of thing that, you know, if the treatment doesn't work, you turn it on the patient as, well, you must have an issue. That it's actually really maddening, because you go to healthcare professionals with a healthcare problem and you're treated like a bad child, a naughty kid. And they say, you know, you really need to cut down the stress in your life. And I feel like saying, what are you going to parent my children? Are you going to pay my mortgage? You know, it's to the point where, you know, I just kind of want to smack them a little bit, because they are throwing out unhelpful commentary and really not addressing the fact that I've come to them with severe pain.
Yeah. Dr. Loader, is this an issue of educating healthcare providers about some of these issues?
I think it is. I mean, not only are those suggestions unhelpful for most patients, they're also completely impractical. As Martha points out, you can't just hide in a cave and live your life so as to avoid every possible migraine trigger. I think it's far more useful to try to label the headache, because making a diagnosis now really does have treatment implications. It used to be that doctors would simply try to figure out if this was a dangerous headache due to something bad like a brain tumor. And if it wasn't, then they just lumped it into the, you know, benign headache category and treated it with nonspecific pain medication. But we have specific medications nowadays, so it's helpful to try to at least get the right diagnosis and some treatment suggestions.
Another call now from Putney, Vermont, is Susan calling. Hi, Susan. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you. I may be able to offer, if just one person some hope, then I'd be happy. I suffered from migraines for 7 years and was on triptans, anticonvulsants, steroids, opiates. Are you there?
Yes. No, we're listening. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Nothing worked, and I was known as the patient that responded to nothing, and I was eventually told by the big doctor at the big fancy hospital that he didn't know what to do for me and that I ought to go to the pain clinic in Ann Arbor or wherever. I happened to have a cold at one last year, and both my eardrums ruptured. And miraculously, for the following 2 weeks, I didn't have a single migraine after having a solid year and a half migraine. So I went to an ear, nose, and throat guy, and he said, oh, sure, your eardrums are ruptured. You must have dysfunctional eustachian tubes, and with the hold in your eardrums, you're able to equalize to ambient barometric pressure. And do the Valsalva maneuver once your eardrums heal 15 times a day, and here's a little balloon to blow up with your nose that they give to kids. And I, after 2 years of not working, I'm back to work and getting my life back.
Wow.
And I had tried... I tried the elimination diet. I stayed away from red wine, caffeine, every brown food. I mean, this was years and many, many drugs. And I'm, you know, and there must be some people out there, not everybody, because this is, there's so many causes for it, but there are some people out there who may not even know that it's weather-related or barometric pressure.
And Susan, thank you so much. What do you make of this, Dr. Loader?
Well, I think that it's wonderful that she's so much better, and while I think that's probably a relatively uncommon cause of chronic headache problems, it does underscore the point that it's important to get a diagnosis, have someone take a look at whether or not there might be underlying explanations for the headache, but also that headache for many people is not a lifetime sentence, and it often does get better. Even people who have very severe migraine, for example, usually will find that they improve as they enter their 50s and 60s. Now, we don't just sit back and wait for that to happen, but it is a nice thing for people to remember that migraine is one of the few chronic illnesses that actually gets better over time and with age for both men and women.
I'd like to bring now another voice into our conversation. Paula Kamen joins us from Chicago. She writes for the New York Times, a blog called Migraine: Perspectives on a Headache. It started up in February, and she's suffered a chronic daily headache herself for the past 17 years. She wrote about her experience in the memoir, All in My Head, an epic quest to cure an unrelenting, totally unreasonable, and only slightly enlightening headache. Paula, nice to have you with us. Thanks.
Hi, thank you.
Tell me about your blog that's been incredibly popular at the New York Times website.
Yeah, there was a regular columnist, Judith Warner, who wrote about, I think it was last fall, about her secret headache problem and about all the things she's been trying to do, and they were just deluged with comments. They got so many they had to stop printing them.
Hmm.
You know, where it seemed like a time that people were very ready to come out of the closet about this and not just blame themselves and share information. And then they decided to have a whole month of guest bloggers, you know, to talk about different aspects, and I'm talking about what's called chronic daily headache, and that's actually it's related physiologically to migraine, but you can tell by the name of it, chronic daily headache, that it's different and that it isn't episodic, in that it could be basically every day. And for a smaller subset of the population like me, the lucky subset of about 0.5 to 0.7% of the population, it's constant, you know, 24/7.
Mm-hmm. So, what treatments have you sought? Maybe I should ask you what you haven't tried.
Yeah, I haven't done Jews for Jesus or colonics. Basically, that's about it.
I've
been hospitalized for weeks and pumped through drugs or pumped with drugs until I was a zombie and hardly knew my own name and how to tie my own shoes. I've been on dozens of different medications, and they're all medications that they use to treat chronic daily headache that are all stolen from other classes, like antidepressants, anti-seizure medications, blood pressure medications. I've tried every type of alternative therapy. I even bought it at one point. I was so desperate that a reason why this book is a comedy is that you'll just do anything, no matter how irrational. You know, at one point, I was watching an infomercial in the middle of the night, and there was a commercial. It was a commercial for a vibrating hat, and I even bought that. And needless to say, that did not work. Mm. You know, I've been to about a dozen acupuncturists, and
So the bottom line is, you just learn to live with it. You just live with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And a lesson that I want to try to impart in the column, that even when you're in a situation like mine, where it is very chronic and hence more difficult to treat,
yeah,
there are still things that you can do to still live as fully as you can, and to manage it, and to try to relieve at least some of the emotional pain and the guilt and self-blame that's often associated with it.
And try to enjoy life a bit.
Right.
Let's go back to the lines now and bring Pat into the conversation from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to share, if I may, a long-time sufferer of migraines and headaches in general over my lifetime. Started when I was a child with what I would call an ice pick headache in my right temple.
Mm-hmm.
And from there progressed into various types of classic migraines into my mid-20s through my pregnancies. Not as frequent. I learned over the years what the triggers were. I learned how to work with the headache process. I learned how to take better care of myself through reducing the triggers and the environmental toxins that contributed to it. I learned how to use supplementation, massage, therapy, all those different things to create a better balance and to get I was getting better connections in my head so that there was better flow and I would reduce the potential.
Mm.
The point that I wanted to make also was that I've been using a prescription triptan for the past year and a half or so, finally went and had this diagnosis because they were increasing, and I'm in the perimenopausal phase. So in doing that, I also discovered recently that my prescription coverage was reduced by my company.
Hmm.
And when I called to appeal to say that 4 tablets a month was not going to cut it, the appeal was denied, basically because I have to now schedule my migraines in order to meet my prescription coverage.
Hmm.
I do see the impact of the sexist portion of this this process. I do feel like because it's a women-related thing primarily, it's been under-noticed, under-medicated, under-prescribed, although I have not had a negative experience in the medical, but that's because I didn't choose a medical way until last year. Mm.
So. Pat, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. Dr. Loader, I'm going to turn it to you. You know, honestly, in disclosure, I have terrible migraines, and this has happened to me, where the limited insurance is a real problem.
Yes, and I have migraine occasionally, too, and I'm sure it would happen to me if I didn't have access to samples. It's a real disgrace, I think, that a problem that for some people can be effectively treated with medications often isn't, just because of insurance company limitations. And I have to think that if men suffered similar severe pains more often than four times a month, that there'd be a lot more outcry about those really draconian limitations that a lot of insurance companies put on the amount of medication that people can get. But I want to get back to something Paula said earlier and just remind everybody out there that chronic daily headache, which by definition means having headache 15 or more days per month, is really a lot more common than people realize. 4 out of every 100 people has headache 15 or more days per month. And I think it's just a disgrace that we don't have better treatment. And I'm really pleased to hear about the groundswell of interest in Paula's blog. And I hope that translates into political action. I think that headache patients, migraine patients, are very far behind patients with other disorders in organizing to demand better research and treatment. And there are some signs that that's changing, and new groups and things like that forming to bring political pressure to bear. And I hope people will translate some of their outrage into action.
Paula is on the phone now from Plymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Paula. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jean.
Hi.
The reason why I was calling is because my mom had suffered from migraines from, I'd say, her early 30s until she went through menopause, which seems to go along with what you were talking about earlier. I, too, started migraines in my 30s, and hopefully as I go through menopause, they'll go away. I haven't noticed any particular triggers, although dehydration, I noticed that your guest had mentioned that, seems to trigger headaches. And if I drink a lot of water once I have one, that can, not always, but can be helpful. I also don't take any prescription medications, because oftentimes if you read them, you know, the side effects are headache and dizziness, and I figure I already have that. I don't need any more of it. But if I take it over-the-counter medication right away, right at the onset, right when I feel like it's coming on, that could help. But again, you know, I could have a migraine that lasts for 3 days, although they're not as frequent as some of your callers have mentioned. I was just wondering if there's been any study about, you know, heredity and if there's a genetic factor involved.
Paula, thank you. Dr. Loader?
Yes, genetic factors are involved in setting your threshold, the likelihood that you'll develop migraine in response to things that happen in the environment. There are some very rare types of migraine with aura that are caused by single genes. And while those are rare, it has provided a way of studying some of the things that might be involved in common migraine, too. But it's very clear that common migraine, garden variety, everyday types of migraine are like other chronic illnesses. It's going to be more than one gene, and it's very complex. So I think the day that genetic research brings us new treatments for migraine is coming, but not as soon as people would like.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about migraines and chronic headaches, diseases that strike 3 times more frequently in women than in men. Joining us this hour is Dr. Elizabeth Loader. She's chief of the Division of Headache and Pain at Brigham and Women's Faulkner Hospitals. We're also joined by Martha Gay. She's suffered with migraines for over 20 years. And by Paula Kamen, a contributor for the New York Times. She's got a new blog out. And I'd like to ask you a little bit more about that. Paula, how do you see your role as an advocate with this blog, as I mentioned, which has been incredibly successful? How do you see yourself as an advocate for headache sufferers in this venue?
Yeah, it's been very exciting to be able to have this platform to talk about headaches as not your fault. That so much of the suffering that takes place with chronic migraine and chronic daily headache is people thinking that it's all their fault or it's all in their heads, And it's been very rewarding to put out just some basic scientific information, just neurology 101 about some of the causes and show them too about how hard it is to treat the most chronic cases, and they aren't alone. You know, if they haven't had success with drugs. And specifically, I'm glad to shed light about chronic daily headache. That it's really it's been incredibly stigmatized. That being more chronic, especially that back in the days when headache was basically in the domain of psychiatrists, the theory was that the more chronic something was, the more psychosomatic it was, that the person became more psychologically attached to the problem and made it more of their personal identity. It was getting quote-unquote secondary gain from that. Mm-hmm. And because of that and a lot of other reasons, it's been extremely difficult to speak out about chronic daily headache. And I'm not even sure if I would have done this even 10 years ago. I basically would have just been saying in public that I'm nuts and want attention. And
what has been the public response to the blog? What are writers saying? The bloggers, co-bloggers, those who read it, what are they saying?
Yeah, it's overall very positive that people out there who have the most chronic cases, they often are so isolated and don't even have a vocabulary to describe what they have or what they've been going through, and it's just this relief to know that they aren't the only one out there. You know, it is also a mixed bag. There's lots of reader posts. After a whole column about talking about how this is not purely psychosomatic, there still will be suggestions about how this might be my negative attitude and how it might be all in my head and there is some influence with people misinterpreting alternative medicine that often talks about the mind-body connection, and people misinterpret that to say that you can always have control over your body with your mind, you know, if you just think positively. So I'm still getting a lot of those comments in the reader comments.
Well, our best to you, and thanks so much for your courage and for your blog in the New York Times, Migraine Perspectives on a Headache. Paula Kamen from Chicago, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Back to the phones now, and Kate, who's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Kate, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
Hi.
I had a question for Dr. Loader and then my own short personal historical perspective,
please,
as it relates. I was wondering what kind of studies there have been into the relationship of hormone levels to migraine. And just from my own experience, I feel like my life has been an unfolding experiment. because I got migraines starting when I was maybe 11 or 12 in the onset of my period, and then I, you know, had them pretty consistently through my 20s and 30s. I didn't have any, as opposed to an earlier caller, but when I was pregnant, I was migraine-free, and that was kind of amazing. And then now that I'm 47, and I'm quite sure perimenopausal, as another caller was too, they seem very clearly tied to my cycle, where I can pretty much chart them the first couple days of my period. I know one is coming, and they've also, because of that, they're fewer, but there have been a couple really intense ones where for the first time I did have to go to the emergency room, and then it just seems to continue through what Dr. Loader was saying about in 50s and 60s, they tend to taper off for women, and it just seems so clear from
that there
my
is
perspective
a link.
Now that it seems, you know, not for everyone again, but that there's some connection to hormones.
Kate, thanks so much for your call. Dr. Loader, do you want to respond?
Well, Kate's absolutely right. There's a very strong connection between female hormonal cycles and migraine activity. Migraine's common in men, but it's even more common in women, and that's probably because the genes that cause people to tend to get headache seem to be activated, or some of the processes that cause headache are activated by hormonal fluctuations. And Kate's done a nice job of outlining some of those connections. The year when menstruation begins is the time when many girls will start to have their first migraine. That's the single highest peak incidence of migraine. In addition, women often note that they tend to get headaches in association with the menstrual flow. That's sometimes referred to as menstrual migraine. Sometimes they'll still get headaches at other times of the month, but be especially likely to get the headaches around their period. For many women, though not all of them, headache does improve with the high, stable estrogen levels of pregnancy, and then can get worse after pregnancy or with any kind of hormonal fluctuation. So as you can imagine, birth control, hormone replacement therapy, menopause, and the perimenopausal period all can be a roller coaster for women who are prone to migraine. Mm.
Colleen now is in East Weymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Colleen. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Thank
Hi.
You. I've had migraines since I was a kid, and I was very grateful in my early 20s to finally have a physician who prescribed something for it. Up till then, I would, you know, go into a dark room and tie a bandana around my head. I have a couple of quick questions for the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading about the possible risk of each migraine that's not averted increasing the risk of possible future cerebral or cardiovascular problems, and that kind of leads to my second question, which is about the potential connection with risk of stroke. Is there any plan on the horizon that you're aware of, Dr. Loader, for screening patients for possibly related defects like PFO?
Good questions, Colleen. Thanks.
Yep, those are all good questions. In particular, with regard to the connection between patent foramen ovale, which is a small opening in between the two upper chambers of the heart, there seems to be an increased chance that people who have aura, that is visual or other neurologic disturbances usually preceding their headache, that people who have aura will have that unusual connection between the two upper chambers of the heart. Now, what isn't clear is whether or not that plays any role in actually triggering the headaches, because another possibility is that some underlying process predisposes people to have both that abnormality and migraine. Mm-hmm. And if that underlying process is the cause of both of them, then interfering with or closing that hole in the heart isn't going to make a difference with migraine. So far, we don't have good enough evidence to say anything to patients about whether or not it's wise to do that. But there is mounting evidence that prolonged or untreated headaches may put some people at risk for later problems. There's some evidence that there are changes in the brain in people who've had long-term, poorly controlled headaches. There is an increased risk of stroke that is largely confined to people who have migraine with aura, compared to people who don't have migraine at all. Hmm. And I think the medical implications of having migraine are going to become clearer to doctors. And in the same way that we now look at people who have diabetes or high cholesterol as people who might be at risk for later problems, it's clear that having a history of migraine probably does put people at slightly increased later risk of stroke and maybe possibly heart attacks as well. Hmm. Now, it's important to put that in context. The elevation of risk is small, and it's probably confined to certain groups of people with migraine. But it is just one more piece of the puzzle, and it helps us make the case that migraine needs to be taken seriously. So it's important.
So if that is a backdrop, then talk a little bit about treatment you have, but in further detail, some of the new treatments for acute and preventative care.
Yeah, well, starting with acute, which is what everybody is usually interested in, that's what do you do when you actually have a headache to either make it go away if you're lucky or at least make it tolerable or somewhat better. There are certainly over-the-counter medications. It's rare that a patient hasn't tried those before they come to the doctor. So almost by definition, by the time they get to us, those things either haven't worked or they're worried that they're taking them too often. There are prescription medications that can be very effective for people who have acute attacks of migraine. The most commonly used class, of course, is the triptans. There are seven of them. They all work reasonably well, and so it's more a matter of finding the right dose than it is finding the right one, although there are some differences in how people react to them. And those work extremely well for people who have intermittent headache. They're not quite as effective for people who have very frequent headaches, and there's a limit on how commonly you can take them. So they only help a subset.
Mm. Interesting. Jordan is on the line now from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Jordan. Welcome to you.
Hi there.
Hi.
This is a great program, and I just wanted to weigh in from the male perspective.
Yes, please.
The lucky 3%. But, I was just curious. I'm 32, and for the last 5 years, I've really started having pretty bad migraines. So I was curious if there is a physiological change in men that that can lead to migraines. And also, now that you're speaking about medication, I've been fairly successful with Fiorasset as a reliever once you get the migraine, but nothing to prevent them, actively prevent you from getting them. Is Fiorasset something that can potentially lead to more migraines, as my doctors told me?
Well, Fiorasset is the brand name for a medication that's a combination of Tylenol, caffeine, and then a mild muscle relaxant or barbiturate. And if it's used too frequently, it is one of the medicines that we suspect can actually make headaches more frequent over time. And as a rough limit, I usually ask patients to limit themselves to using those kinds of medications no more than 2 days a week maximum. If you're using it more frequently than that, or if it's not effective, then you might be a candidate for either a stronger acute medication, maybe a triptan, or preventive medication, which is something taken every day to cut down on the likelihood that an attack will occur.
Hmm. Kimberly is on the line now from Springfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Kimberly. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm going to echo the last caller. I'm calling about a boy. I have a son who is 8 years old who's been suffering from migraines for the last 2 years, and we have figured out his trigger in that he gets migraines almost every single time he's tired or run down. And they come on very quickly. His doctor suggested that as they start to come on or as he starts to look run down, to give him Tylenol, but that sometimes helps and sometimes doesn't. I'm wondering if he's too young for to consider a prescription, and also whether there are any kind of long-term impact to a child at that age who suffers from migraines, and are there any kind of neurological connections? Should I be concerned about other things happening in his brain?
Long-term damage. Kimberly, thanks so much. Good luck.
I don't think you need to worry especially about that. And thanks to you for reminding us that migraine can happen in children. It's more common than I think people realize. And before puberty, boys are actually a little more likely than girls to have migraine. Some of them then later outgrow it. And of course, it would be nice if that happened for your son. The triptans, which work so well for adults, have been extensively tested in children and adolescents. And they certainly appear to be safe, but they aren't as effective in children as they are in adults. And in particular, the studies have had difficulty showing that they work better than placebo. Now, there are a number of possible reasons for that. Kids' headaches are very short and build up very, very quickly compared to adult headaches, and a number of other possibilities. So the bottom line is that triptans are not approved for use in kids or adolescents. Many headache specialists do use them anyway because they're effective for individual children, and of course, you can't know that without trying them. But the only medication that I'm aware of that's been carefully shown to be helpful for some children with migraine is ibuprofen. So that might be the next step up from acetaminophen, and you could think of discussing that with your doctor.
Mm. Martha,
I'd like to comment.
I was going to go to you as well.
I'd like to comment on the role of sleep.
Yes. Sleep
is a really, I think, an underrated player in the whole migraine scheme. It's known to be a problem if people get too little or too much sleep. And this is a really interesting thing, because when you get a migraine, you're supposed to go lie down and try to sleep. Hmm. And yet if you get too much, it can trigger a migraine.
That's bad,
if you get
too.
Yes. And so one of the things that is talked about a lot of the time when it comes to migraine treatment is the importance of good sleep hygiene. And that was something I had never even heard before, this concept of sleep hygiene. And the idea is that you try real hard to go to bed at the same time each night and get up at the same time each morning, whether it's a weekday or a weekend, so that you are establishing a regular rhythm.
A regulated pattern. Yeah.
Yes. And
you know what? I'm running out of time, Martha.
Really helpful.
I'm going to interrupt you. I'm so sorry, but we're running out of time. And I just wonder, with our last few seconds here, if you look forward to the day when you don't have a migraine, or after 24 years, you just learn to live with it.
I've accepted the fact that this is the body I have. And I find it a lot easier to just roll with it. And sure, I'm probably one of the few women who really looks forward to menopause, because this is, you know, a good chance that maybe it's going to get better for me. But, you know, I'm not planning for it to get better. I just, when I get a migraine, I don't get emotionally involved with it. It happens, and I let it be done and get on with my life. I am not migraine. It's a part of my life, but it is not my life, and that attitude has served me well. It took me a long time to get to this place, but it's certainly something that I've come to accept, and I've moved on.
I completely understand. Martha Gay in Madison, Wisconsin, I really appreciate your time and your thoughts. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Dr. Elizabeth Loader, Chief of the Division of Headache and Pain at Brigham and Women's Faulkner Hospitals, thank you very much for your insights and your medical perspective. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.